Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
When we think about how to engage China and the competition that it poses and the challenge that it poses, we really have to start with us, because in many ways, it's about us.
Meet America's newest top diplomat. But what kind of world will the new administration inherit? I asked former U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Anthony Gardner, and former British Foreign Secretary, David Miliband. And
gender equality has to be more than an aspiration.
The message is change, as mayors from six of the world's great cities join forces for gender equality. The leaders of London and Mexico City join me with their new initiative. Then,
the people you're criticizing are as complicated as you are, and they're learning just like you're learning.
Professor and activist Loretta J. Ross tells our Michelle Martin about challenging cancel culture and calling people in instead of out. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The transition from the Trump to the Biden administration is now officially underway. The necessary funds and machinery to make way for President-elect Joe Biden are now authorized, and he is wasting no time announcing key members of his incoming administration. Many are familiar faces from the Obama era, and there is a clear message.
It's a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. And it's a team that reflects the fact that America is back. The team meets this moment, this team behind me. They embody my core beliefs that America is strongest when it works with its allies. Collectively, this team has secured some of the most defining national security and diplomatic achievements in recent memory, made possible through decades of experience working with our partners.
So his pick for Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, speaks volumes about the alliance-driven, multilateral direction of Biden's foreign policy. But even as America First is removed from the sloganeering, 4 years of Trump policy have seen the U.S. withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, the WHO, the nuclear deal with Iran, and also leave behind an empowered China and a diminished transatlantic alliance. This is a different world than the one Joe Biden left as vice president back in 2017. So to discuss what's ahead, former U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Anthony Gardner, joins me from Italy, and former British Foreign Secretary and head of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband, joins us from New York City. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. So I'm going to just start with asking you your initial reaction to the foreign policy and national security team that President-elect Joe Biden has just unveiled. First, you, as an American in Europe, Anthony Gardner.
Well, look, it's a terrific team. It's a very experienced team. I've known Tony Blinken for a very long time. As a kid growing up, we went to school together. I worked with him twice in the U.S. government. I've seen him in the trenches in some really difficult situations with a lot of pressure. He led the interagency effort after Russia invaded Ukraine, which was very tough to get everyone aligned, but also dealing with big egos around the table. Not only does he have the right professional qualifications, he also is an exceptional individual. It's very hard to find anyone in the U.S. government to have a negative word to say about Tony Blinken. That's extremely rare. And he believes, as you just said in the clip, he believes in allies working with our friends in Europe to achieve results, particularly with China and Russia and the other challenges.
So, David Miliband, with both your hats on, not just humanitarian and refugees driven, but also as a former foreign secretary, what do you see as a European? What do you see as the message from President-elect Biden?
I think that the most the whole message from the president-elect was not the word back in America's back, but the word team that he emphasized so many times in the clip that you played. Government officials, in my experience, are made by character and characteristics. And this group of people are low on ego, high on experience, are serious about values, but they're also people who know that there is a time to lead and a time to listen. So I think this is a moment that sends a very important message, both to those who are allies of America, get ready for business, we've got work to do. It also says to rivals, we're not going to be working on our own anymore. We're going to be working with others. We'll be looking to cooperate where we can, but we'll have to compete in a range of areas. And that's going to be done in a serious and developed and cross-governmental way, because this team is not a team of rivals, it's a team of colleagues.
So you yourself have called for the incoming administration to put an extra $20 billion for, I believe, refugees, and also to spruce up their asylum process. I want to play this little bit because Tony Blinken's speech was remarkable for his real life experience, given his parents and his family, in the issue of humanitarian and international law and refugees. Let's just play this.
For my family, as for so many generations of Americans, America has literally been the last best hope on earth. Vera Blinken fled communist Hungary as a young girl and helped future generations of refugees come to America. My mother, Judith Pizar, builds bridges between America and the world through arts and culture. She is my greatest champion. And my late stepfather, Samuel Pizar. He was one of 900 children in his school in Bialystok, Poland, but the only one to survive the Holocaust after 4 years in concentration camps.
And he went on to say that his stepfather was rescued by an American tank battalion, and the soldier who popped his head out to welcome him, he made a point of saying, was an African-American. It was really quite remarkable. But I want to ask you both then, in terms of actual foreign policy and soft power, what this means. Let me ask you first, Tony Gardner. What does this mean? Is it important, that kind of experience? And if so, why, for the foreign policy of a superpower?
It was a formative experience for him. I knew Sam Pizar, and I know how much of an impact it had on Tony Blinken. You know, one of the favorite phrases that Tony has used for many years now is that we shouldn't just use the example of our power. We should use the power of our example. And another phrase he likes using, I think quite correctly, is that we need not just convince people in their minds and their convictions, but also win over their hearts, so hearts and minds. That's the kind of person he is. And I think it goes all the way back to his years at Harvard as an undergraduate. He wrote his undergraduate thesis called Ally versus Ally. It was on the Soviet pipeline crisis, which really split the alliance, Europe versus the United States. And one of the conclusions of that book is that the United States needs to work with its power in a judicious way. And not abuse it. And that if we are split in terms of an alliance, we end up, you know, harming ourselves.
David Miliband, again, this is a big focus for you right now. This, as I said, refugees, asylum. You know, there's the Mexican-US border. There's, you know, there's all over the world the Yemen refugees, refugees that are happening right now in Ethiopia as a war really gathers pace there, and they're moving into Sudan. Again, what do you hope, and do you really think the politics of America after these 4 years will allow a new administration to put that amount of money that you're calling for into this particular issue?
Well, let me say two things that are very important. First of all, we're living in the age of COVID. COVID is the central first responsibility for the incoming administration at home. And our argument is that you have to beat COVID abroad as well as beat it at home if you're to get back to any kind of normality. The $20 billion that we've argued for is specifically to tackle the health impacts of COVID and the collateral economic damage as part of a global plan to ensure that the international response to COVID matches up to the scale of the domestic response. Up till now, only a fraction of the attention has been paid to the global consequences, and we need to right this ship. The second part that is very important and speaks directly to Tony Blinken's history, but actually speaks to the present, is that we're living in an age of impunity. We're living in an age when both state and non-state actors are guilty of war crimes and breaches of international humanitarian law around the world. And I'm afraid that the way in which the administration over the last 4 years has refused to recognize the rights, for example, of asylum seekers that you have mentioned, has contributed to this age of impunity. This incoming team stands for a rules-based approach to international order that will start with issues that are close to home to do with health or climate change, but it will go broader to the bigger geopolitical questions that confront the world that is increasingly interdependent. Countries are tied together as never before, but the global commons and the rules by which they are governed are weakly enforced. That is the central challenge that this administration needs to lead the world in addressing. And I think that they have the smarts to do it. They have the values to do it. What they've got to do is build the momentum. And that's not just up to them. It's about up to European and other partners around the world join with them.
So, Tony Gardner, you've been the ambassador to the EU. Do you think the Europeans are up to this now? Do they see this new, certainly the new message, the new administration? Or do they think that these last 4 years have, in a way, irrevocably changed the idea of multilateralism and all the other traditional things that the United States didn't just do, but led? What do they expect from a new administration?
Well, I think most of European countries are overjoyed, and including the EU institutions are overjoyed by the change of administration. But of course they're worried that this could be washed away in 4 years, and of course there's no guarantee. And all of that means that we better succeed together. And it means that we, if we want to go far, we have to go together, and it means that Europe has to ask itself the questions you suggested. What can it do to ensure that the model of working with allies within the rules, with institutions, is a better way than going unilaterally, bilaterally, transactionally, which was the Donald Trump way of doing business? And that has failed. Even with a trade deal with China, it's failed because, in fact, the trade deficit with China has gone up. It hasn't gone down. And he has signally failed to achieve what he promised to achieve. So a lot is at stake. And in the work that was done in the transition leading up to the election, a lot of focus was on what can be done within 18 months, 24 months to prove that case.
So you mentioned China. So I want to go to some specific, hard policy issues. And China obviously is one of them. It's a big challenge for the U.S., but also for Europe. A few months ago, I interviewed Tony Blinken, as he was then, about China. And this is what he said about what had happened under the 4 years of the Trump administration.
Think about this. President Trump has helped China advance its key strategic goals. Weakening American alliances? Check. Leaving a vacuum in the world for China to try to fill? Check. Abandoning our own values and giving Beijing a green light to trample on human rights and democracy in Xinjiang or in Hong Kong? Check. And maybe worst of all, debasing our own democracy every day by attacking its institutions, its people, its values, and so reducing its appeal. That's what I like to call checkmate.
So he went on to say that the best way to check China is to really strengthen American values, democracy, and all the other institutions. David, as Foreign Secretary, you've had to deal with a whole load of challenges. What do you see as the biggest challenge? I mean, how should America or Europe view China as a competitor, as something to be contained? What can one do different? Because everybody seems to think that there has to be some kind of change between the West and China and the relationship.
Well, I think that China, the country, the civilization, is not just one issue in the foreign policy packet. It's a framing question of geopolitics in the 21st century. And the truth is that China is both a rival and a cooperating colleague, and in some places a partner, and in some places a source of confrontation to the rest of the world. You only have to think about the clash between India and China over the last couple of months to see that there's room for constant confrontation as well as cooperation. My own view, very strongly, is that there needs to be an approach of cooperation where possible, competition where necessary, confrontation where nothing else is possible. And I think that the fact that we've got the COVID issue and the climate issue as top of the docket allows the US and China to start off on a cooperative footing. I think it's very important not to underestimate that in this brimming intray, there are real incentives for the US and for China to cooperate on both the global health issue and on the climate issue. It's also important to say that the relations with Europe are not separate from the China issue. They're absolutely integral to it, because it's very, very important that we don't fall into the trap of seeing the 21st century as simply being a G2 world, a group of two worlds. America will be stronger with allies, but it's also the case that we're inevitably living in a more multipolar world. Europe is a regulatory and environmental superpower already. It needs to be part of the equation. And the fact that it could be an alliance with the US is a very significant aspect of the new dispensation in Washington.
Anthony Garland, let me ask you, because you've probably read the same articles that I have, and there are a certain number of academics and liberals inside China, and even in Hong Kong, like the Jimmy Lai, who's got the big media empire there, who's also a reformer. But they actually see President Trump as having stuck it to the Communist Party of China. And they think that, you know, when it comes to sort of trying to get the claws of the Communist Party out of people's business and their freedoms, that Trump actually did something that no other president has done. Do you buy that, even with the caveats you said, the trade tariffs haven't worked and the trade deal, et cetera, hasn't worked? What changes do you think a Biden administration will have to do anyway to confront those aspects of Chinese dominance?
No, I don't agree with that assessment at all. Donald Trump didn't discover that China is a challenge to Europe and to the United States. Many other presidents understood that and were very tough, and Obama was one of them, about the rights of navigation, about the South China Sea, about the importance of human rights. Those issues aren't going to go away. This president-elect is going to focus very much on human rights, something that Donald Trump hasn't done. Not with the expectation that we're going to change China overnight. Of course, that won't happen. But because it's an important issue, we need to shine the uncomfortable light on the situation of the oppressed minorities, in this case, the Muslims in Xinjiang. But what will change is tactics, tactics, tactics. What matters is how much you get done. And certainly in trade, which I mentioned before, very little has been achieved. And we're going to achieve more by leveraging the power of our markets. And believe me, China takes that very seriously. China has not only an economic program to dominate the industries of the future and to dominate trade, but also write the standards of trade and enshrine its values across the world. And we're only going to be able to meet that challenge if we work with our allies, not only the EU, but Canada, Japan, Australia, and others. That's what's going to be different. Now, I just want to say this. I agree completely with what David Miliband said. It's not saying that China is just a threat, but also can be a collaborator. And China is a good example. Xi Jinping made an important announcement that China wants to be carbon neutral by 2060. Now let's hold China to that promise. There are other areas as well where we can collaborate and should with China.
So that's fascinating. Also that President-elect Biden has actually named a special climate envoy, none other than former Secretary of State John Kerry, which brings me to the Iran nuclear deal, because he also negotiated that over a long period of time. Jake Sullivan, who's just been named National Security Advisor, was also one of those negotiating that. And that is something that Joe Biden has said he wants to re-enter. So, David Miliband, can he, I mean, obviously Europeans are already trying to reach out to this administration to try to get back into this deal in some way. How do you, I mean, the Iranians have said they want to as well, but it's probably not that simple. Where do you see the areas of progress on that possible?
Well, first of all, the vital point to remember is that the question of the Iranian nuclear program sits at the middle of bigger questions about the changing region of the Middle East. At the moment, the top item on the docket for the incoming administration is going to be the Yemen conflict. It's the largest humanitarian catastrophe in the world. 80 million people depend on international humanitarian aid, a completely failed and misbegotten war strategy of the Saudi-led coalition, which actually started before the Trump administration came in, but which is now widely recognized to have completely failed both in its political goals, because Iran has got stronger in Yemen over the last 5 years, not weaker, and also caused this humanitarian catastrophe. So I think the first thing to say is that there are really biting diplomatic needs that are going to command attention. Now, you're right to also say that the Iranian nuclear program is one which is now further advanced than when the Iran nuclear program was in operation until 2016-17. There are two sides to every negotiation. I think the first thing to say is it's going to be very important that the US rejoins, not just with Europeans, but with Russia and China, because remember, it was a P5, the permanent members of the Security Council, all together with Germany, who negotiated with Iran. Secondly, there's going to have to be a very careful calculation about the right amount of pressure and engagement that is put on Iran, because the secret of success under the Obama administration for the Iranian nuclear deal was that combination of both pressure and engagement.
It's really fascinating because obviously the secret of the Trump administration has been to encourage and enable Israel, the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia against Iran. Where do you see that going under a new administration, Anthony Gardner?
Well, every effort will be made to save the Iran nuclear negotiations. But a lot of water has gone under the bridge. David is the expert here. There may be some significant pressure, including from Congress, to consider expanding the scope of the deal, perhaps even the term of the deal. And we'll see whether that will occur. The Iranians haven't gotten the benefit of the bargain that they thought they were going to get in terms of the economic benefits. But I agree completely with the analysis that the region is not any safer from the fact that the United States has walked away from that. There are some things the Donald Trump administration has done which are indeed achievements. We just saw news in the last 24 hours that Prime Minister Netanyahu apparently traveled secretly to Saudi Arabia. That's an incredible piece of news. And three Arab countries have recognized Israel and made peace with Israel. Those are achievements. But I just want to say that it seems to me rather extraordinary to think that we can actually reach a lasting peace in the region without the inclusion, participation of a partner, an important partner, the Palestinian people. So I suspect that is going to change. It won't be an emphasis of simply putting peace agreements on the table and say, sign on the dotted line.
Thank you both so much, Anthony Gardner and David Miliband. Thank you for all this perspective. A lot to look forward to and analyze as we go on. Thanks a lot. And now we switch our lens from nations to cities as drivers of change. 257 years. What's that? That is how long it'll take to close the gender gap in economic participation and opportunity between men and women based on current trends. And that is according to the World Economic Forum. But not if we do something about it. And that is the message from six mayors from some of the world's largest cities on four different continents. A new international initiative called Change looks at local government as the solution to problems of equality facing women. And I discussed all of this with the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and the mayor of Mexico City, Claudia Sheinbaum. Mayors, welcome to the program. First of all, to you, Mayor Sheinbaum, in Mexico City. What has COVID done to the cities? I mean, we hear a lot, particularly in relation to gender, as we are discussing right now. How have women been affected in Mexico City?
Well, COVID has affected a lot in Mexico City. It has been very, very difficult, and it had hit very hard. And especially for women, has been difficult, not only in terms of violence inside the household, inside the houses. But right now it is very difficult because children haven't gone to school for 8 months since now. So as you know, most of the children are taken care of by women. So women that used to go to work now have to be with the children. So this has made a very, very difficult time for many families, and it has touched everything.
Let me ask you, Mayor Sadiq Khan, obviously there's a big difference between the resources of a rich city like London and perhaps not so resource-rich in Mexico City. So I want to ask you what this pandemic has done to women. And let me just start by reading you from the McKinsey Global report that found in the United States, women made up 43% of the workforce, but accounted for 56% of COVID-related job losses. Do you see anything similar here in London?
Absolutely. One of the reasons we were keen to set up this network of great cities across the globe was to share our experiences, but also some of the solutions. Now, COVID hasn't been some great leveler. We all may be facing the same storm, but we're in different sized boats. What we've noticed in London is, yes, there have been catastrophic health and economic consequences, but the impact on women economically, socially, and psychologically has been far worse than on men. I'll give you an amazing number, which is if you're a mother, you're 50% more likely to have lost your job or resigned than if you're a father. And for the reasons that the mayor of Mexico City said, it's women mums who have been doing the childcare arrangements while children have been at home. It's been the mums, the mothers, been doing the home schooling. And what we've got to realize is actually what COVID has done is both amplified the inequalities that exist as well as highlighted them as well.
So what are you doing? Let me just stick with you for a moment, Mayor Sadiq Khan. What are you doing actually in this city, or what do you hope that this change agenda that you're calling for will do to protect the most vulnerable, in this case, the women?
Well, one of the things that we've noticed as mayors is actually national governments are very slow to respond to what's happening on the ground. Mayors and cities can be far more nimble and quicker. So in London, we've invested millions of pounds of money in giving women who are the victims and survivors of domestic abuse, which has shot up during the lockdown, respites. They've got more refuges, more hotels, more places to go to. We've invested in relation to the skills agenda, a £300 million budget that's helping women in particular upskill, get the skills they need to get a job, those women who've lost their jobs. We're supporting women when it comes to the support they need during this pandemic. There's an amazing number in London, I'm sure it's the case in the other cities around the globe, which is that 8 out of 10 of the lowest paid jobs are done by women. So if we can upskill women, if we can give them the skills that are future-proof for better paid jobs, we can get them out of the poorer paid jobs that are more susceptible to this pandemic into safer jobs that are more secure for them and their families.
So let me turn to you, Mayor Sheinbaum, because you started by talking about the violence against women, particularly in this pandemic time with everybody sort of crammed in and no way to escape. There have been a huge uptick in calls by women to, you know, emergency hotlines and a big increase in domestic abuse and murders. Is it a real worry for you? And what can you do as a mayor, particularly in this time, to protect women?
And during the three more dramatic months of pandemia in Mexico City, we increased this scholarship for all the children in Mexico City that go to public schools. And right now we're giving a food support for all the children. We're talking about 1,200,000 children from 3 to 15 years old in the city. The other thing is that we have an agenda related to reduction of violence for women in the city. And this agenda started last year. We also are sanction what we call the violence in digital, in social media. We also approved a DNA bank for sexual aggressors. And also a very important law, we are protecting women that suffer from violence at home. We are guaranteed that the aggressor has to go out of the house independently of the ownership of the house.
What sort of strength in numbers, what sort of, I don't know, help do you think you get assistance from being part of this new initiative?
Well, it's very, very important because many cities have lived this problem related to violence for women and also support for women in general. And I think it is very important the experience that have lived many, many other cities in terms of public policies, and we can learn a lot And we can discuss some of these problems that we share together, just only to live in cities, and especially for women. So it's, for us, it's very important, this network that is formed.
Sadiq Khan, you have said in the past, and let me get it correct, that cities are the political future. You know, you said the 19th century was about empire, the 20th about nations, and the 21st will be about cities. What do you mean by that, particularly now at the end of 2020, at the end of this extraordinary year, and while everybody's talking about building back better after this pandemic?
Well, we've seen across the globe a greater urbanization. More and more people are moving to cities and living in cities. It's the reality we face. What we're going to do is not be scared of that growth in our cities, but to plan for it. And what you're seeing is mayors being incredibly nimble and setting up networks to work closer together, to share best practice, to have big C collaboration and small C competition. So we work close together in areas like climate change, in areas to do with culture. And what this latest network is about is cities working closer together to tackle sexism, misogyny, and gender-based injustices, making sure that we can, you know, copy best ideas where we've got. But also the sense of solidarity is so important. The reality is, in London, in my view, the most progressive city in the world, if you're born a girl, your life chances are less than if you're born a boy. That can't be right in 2020.
Indeed. And I just wonder whether you also are thinking about tackling the gender pay gap in these cities and as part of the initiative. Because, you know, you're talking about best practices, Sadiq Khan, and you've seen possibly New Zealand just recently has taken on a whole raft of initiatives and laws, actually, to talk about pay equity rather than equal pay. It basically means getting the, you know, getting paid for an equal amount of work. What do you take from that? And do you have any ideas about how to close this gap?
Well, look, Jacinda Ardern is a political friend, and she was here in City Hall speaking to young children with actually Justin Trudeau to inspire and encourage them not to be embarrassed, but to be proud of being feminist, to explain what it means to be a feminist. And we're emulating a number of the policies that progressives like Jacinda Ardern have been doing in New Zealand. So in City Hall, we think it's really important to be transparent. When I became mayor, nobody knew, for example, what the pay of our staff were. I published it and we discovered, lo and behold, men were getting paid far more than women, ostensibly because in the senior position, it tended to be blokes doing the jobs. In the junior positions, women. We've changed that around. 7 of the 10 deputy mayors in that grey city are women. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner is a woman. We appointed the first women commissioner, and we've reduced that pay gap there used to be, so it's now almost zero. And it's really important for us to recognise, if those that say there aren't talented women, and that's why we can't appoint them, my message to them is you're mixing with the wrong people and looking in the wrong places. And that's why, additionally, we've set up sponsorship schemes to make sure that our newer talent who are women, whether it's middle management or senior management, have the sponsorship and the support they need to get the top jobs. It's really important. I'm a firm believer you can't be it if you can't see it. And that's why we're so proud that the vice president-elect of one of the greatest countries in the world is Kamala Harris, a woman, and indeed a woman of colour.
OK, so that's really interesting. Let me ask you then, Mayor Sheinbaum, do you have the same feeling, the same reaction to the fact that the new vice president in the United States is not just a woman, but a woman of colour? First time ever.
Well, that's very, very important. What she represents, I mean, that's very important for women all over the world, because I think one of the things that it's important is an example. It's not just laws and regulations, which is very, very important, but also the example of having a woman elected as vice president of the United States or a chief of government that is women. In my case, for example, and in the case of the federal government, half of the cabinet are women. And that's very important as an example for all the society.
Let me finally end with you, Mayor Khan. You and President Trump famously sparred throughout the 4 years. And it was on the values, actually. And I think it started perhaps with the Muslim ban that you spoke up very, very prominently about. And I think I might have been a mediator in some of these, or rather the interlocutor in some of these comments that have been flying around the Atlantic. So A long way of saying the transition is now officially underway. President Trump has apparently bowed to reality. How do you see things being different under a Biden administration?
Well, I've got to tell you, for those watching in the USA, we in the UK are incredibly excited by the election in the US and the fact that there'll be a Biden-Harris team in the White House, President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris. It's really important for Americans to realize that many of us around the world love America, love Americans, and you are the beacon for a whole host of things, liberty, freedom, human rights, equality, and many of us revere your country. But over the last 4 years, I'm afraid the tone that your president has set has led to many of us asking searching questions about the special relationship, about what America stands for. And to show that democracy works and to show what a great country America is, the American people have chosen a different path over the next at least 4 years. And we're really excited that you're going to rejoin the climate change agreement, excited that you're going to continue to play a prominent role in the WHO, excited about the role you're going to play in NATO and the United Nations. And, you know, for the rest of us, not just in London, the UK, in Europe, around the world, we're looking forward to the Biden-Harris presidentship, and we're really excited.
And I guess lastly to you then, Mayor Sheinbaum, Mexicans have been the target of the current Trump administration, particularly at the border. Do you have a view as to whether that will change under a new administration? And do you think it should change?
I mean, we have to defend the people that live in the U.S., especially the Mexican people. For example, cities as Los Angeles have millions and millions of Mexicans living there. My sister lives there. So I think we have to defend the Mexican people that lives in the U.S. Against any discrimination. And in that sense, that's our policy.
Mayor Claudia Sheinbaum, Mayor Sadiq Khan, thank you both very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And just a note to mark the passing of another mayor, David Dinkins, the first black mayor of New York City. He died on Monday at the age of 93, and he spent his life trying to improve race relations and champion economic equality in his city and beyond. Now, creating conversations across borders, like my previous guests are trying to do, is hard enough. But in the wild west of the internet, it can be even tougher, especially when one perceived misstep can see someone called out or canceled. These two things can close down dialogue without remedying the problem. And that's the view of my next guest, Smith College Visiting Associate Professor Loretta J. Ross. Here she is speaking to our Michelle Martin about teaching a class on exactly that subject.
Thanks, Christian. Professor Ross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
You know, you've had such a long and varied career, both in the academy and in activism. I'm just wondering how you brought all that together with this course at Smith on cancel culture.
Well, I actually had a longer career in activism than I had in the academy. I've only been teaching for 5 years because I only graduated college when I was 55. So I was an activist. I started out in Washington, D.C., going to Howard University and became the third executive director of the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. Stayed in the women's movement for a long, long time until 1990, when I became part of the staff of the National Anti-Klan Network. And that's where I encountered hate groups for the first time. And my job was to monitor them and find out about them. But my boss was Reverend C.T. Vivian. And he had said a long time ago when I first came, he said, Loretta, when you ask people to give up hate, then you need to be there for them when they do. And this like stunned me because I wasn't ready to like not hate the Klan. And in fact, he was right. And so working with Leonard Zeskin, my research director, we started doing programming of people who left the hate movement, the neo-Nazi movement, the Klan, the militias, the skinheads, and all of that. And that's led me to today, because I felt that if you could learn how to talk to the Klan, ex-Klansmen, ex-militias, ex-rapists, you should be able to talk to somebody that made a mistake, that used a blue joke you didn't like, or all of the things that I'm witnessing over social media, where people are so easy to take offense to things that people may or may not know are offensive, and then they want to cancel them for doing it. So there's this whole culture of unforgivability, like there, you got to get everything perfectly right when you open up your mouth, and heaven help you if someone finds something bad on tape that you said 20 years ago, because you can get fired for it.
I understand that your class is very popular, which speaks to that the fact that there's a hunger for a way to talk about these issues. Talk to me a little bit more, if you would, about how does your class work?
Well, first of all, on the very first day of class, I tell them, there are no trigger warnings in this class. If you think that you're going to be upset by anything you or your classmates say, I really suggest that you drop out right now, because we're going to have frank and honest discussions about the political issues of the day, of the different ways that we need to become civically minded students and participants in building our democracy that's actually never been, because we have to work on ensuring equality and justice. It's still a process. Matter of fact, I think we're in the continuing civil war over what America will be. And so I don't use trigger warnings. I also don't think that learning should be a hazing process. Mm. And so I give them a ton of reading that I expect them to do. I tell them that they're going to be reading from both liberal and conservative writers, because you need to have a range of material available to you to make up your mind what you believe. And I tell them, don't even believe me, because I want you to have that critical skepticism all of your life.
What effect have you seen on your students? I mean, as you know, of course, conservatives have made this one of their causes, particularly on college campuses. Like one conservative senator said the other day that, you know, who went to Princeton, he says, I couldn't have survived at Princeton now because, you know, cancel culture, you know, would have destroyed me. And so obviously conservatives are very, you know, it's been sort of a cause celeb among conservatives. But for yourself, as a self-described radical Black feminist, what effect do you see on your students?
Well, first of all, some students are afraid to speak up because they want to get the perfect thought out there before they get pounced on. But I do want to go back up a little bit and talk about conservatives. What we are witnessing is people being able to democratize free speech. And you have to understand that everybody with the keyboard can hold you accountable for the words that you said, for the things that you've done. And if you don't want to get in trouble, stop saying those words, stop doing those things, and run in front of the bad stories from your life. I mean, hold up to your stuff. But I think it's projection when the right wing and conservatives talk about the cancel culture as if we're foisting it on them. I mean, I seem to recall them being a little mad about Harry Potter or the Passion of Christ or a whole lot of things that they object to in popular culture. And they're right. Right now, they're trying to boycott rainbow-colored Oreo cookies, I mean, because they think it represents a gay lifestyle. And so it's a bit much for them to claim that it's a problem of the left canceling them, when most of the cancellations, like the bullets, go from the right to the left. But nevertheless, I think it's really important that we start establishing what we call democratic speech environments, where people use their speech to work towards justice, fairness, and equality versus shame, blame, and cheap publicity when you blow up somebody's life.
What would that look like?
That would look like, first of all, teaching on our campuses the proper use of the First Amendment, that is an obligation for governments not to violate, but private institutions have to prioritize the safety and learning environment of our students. And so we need to teach them how to use the First Amendment, teach them not to overreact when someone uses the wrong gender pronoun or, you know, uses an outdated word like retarded or something, but show them that the people you're criticizing are as complicated as you are, and they're learning just like you're learning. And so we have to have grace and forgiveness as we live in this pluralistic society, and we learn that everybody won't have to agree with us to be with us. And so a democratic speech environment is something we're talking a lot of about in our campuses right now, so that we further the goals of democracy rather than use free speech to bring down democracy, which we've endured for the last 4 years.
You've also seen issues where scholars, I'm thinking about sort of Charles Murray, who at the American Enterprise Institute, who's retired now. Many of people, you know, there have been people over time who have felt that his scholarship has veered into kind of racist gradations of people according to, you know, racist sort of gradations of people's intelligence. I mean, he denies that, but that nevertheless is the perception some have of him, where his speeches on campuses have been shut down by students who object to it. How do you see that?
Racialized science has no place on modern campuses. There's a good use for science, but we who are scientists, that I majored in chemistry and physics, I wouldn't invite anybody to the campus that believes that the earth is flat. And I'm not going to invite anybody to the campus that believes that there's a racial hierarchy that they use all this bad science to prove just so that they can establish themselves as a dominant race. We don't have to entertain bad science anymore, racialized science anymore. That era is over. If we actually want to use logic and science, that we want everybody who has a pet theory about the flat earth to run our science departments, go at it. But the quality schools and the high caliber students we have know not to let, you know, academia be poisoned or continue to be poisoned by racism and white supremacy, and particularly racialized science.
But if by that standard, I mean, some of these students want to hear from these people, and you have to assume
they have the right to hear from them. But does the college have the obligation to attach the college's name to a flat earth theory? There's a flat earth society outside the campus. They can easily join, but they don't have to speak in our auditoriums, in our halls, to push what we know is not evidence-based stuff. We want evidence. That's our job to teach how you have a critical mind, how you seek and support evidence, how you prove facts. You don't want people's opinions to be paraded as facts and then taught to students, because then you failed as an educational institution.
Professor Ross, are there some people who deserve to be canceled? I mean, is there some element of justice to it that perhaps isn't available through other means, like things that fall in that gray area where, you know, maybe behavior doesn't rise to a level of a legal sanction for whatever reason, but, you know, a social sanction is warranted. Does anybody deserve to be canceled in your view?
Yeah, of course there's messed up people in the world. And there are people who I'd rather not have in my company or in my school or in my church or whatever. But that's not the majority of people. Most cancellations are done horizontally for people who have the same power you are not criminals trying to really go out and hurt people. They're just trying to be themselves. And so, yes, some people probably need a different solution than a wonderful sentence just asking, did you mean what you said about that? Or, I beg your pardon, that didn't land on me too well. I mean, we can use sentences of invitation to ask people to tell us more instead of assuming the worst about them and going into a quick cancellation. But yes, of course, we have miscreants that do harm to people. I'm talking about real physical criminal harm to people that we need to take care of appropriately. But that's not what I'm talking about in the cancel culture. I'm talking about people really punishing people, often for what they think, what they look like, what they say, and really not showing any kind of context or nuance or making them accountable for what they say, but doing it with anger and punishment instead of love and forgiveness.
What's your take on the use of the word safety as a way to initiate cancellation of people? Because what you hear often today is that people will say, this person's words make me feel unsafe. And what is your thought about that?
Well, as part of the founders of the anti-violence movement in this country, I think we started that mess because we overpromised people who had experienced sexual and domestic violence safety, because we wanted to make it possible for them to tell their stories often for the first time in their lives, and that we would hold their stories in a safe space. But since the 1970s, now safety can be attached to just mere discomfort. I don't like that word you use. You made me feel unsafe. I don't like the fact that you got my pronoun wrong. You make me feel unsafe. Oh, I don't like that you're eating meat in my presence. You make me feel unsafe. I mean, it's just gone to a ludicrous level and to where it's almost like we're growing up expecting the world to cater to our highly individualized need for safety. And in a way, we're not developing any stamina or resilience to deal with the world as it is, instead of trying to make it the way we'll be most comfortable and safe.
Hmm. Except that violence does begin with words. I mean, I'm thinking about most violence does begin, state-sponsored violence particularly begins with words. In fact, interpersonal violence often begins with words.
Well, I don't think you heard me say anything that words don't have consequences. I think words wound. So I'm not a First Amendment absolutist that I believe that all words don't have consequences. I think words have severe consequences, which is why people should be made accountable for what they say. But I'm still saying it can be done with respect and love instead of punishment in most instances. Yes, if you're calling for the massacre of people, if you're calling for the excommunication of people or someone to lose their job because you didn't like their opinion, I think you really need to rethink that opinion out, because you have to be responsible for the consequences of your words, just like you expect them to be responsible for the consequences of their words. Mm. We are in a struggle to protect this democracy that's still emerging. We are in a fight of our lives. We're in the greatest human rights struggle right now that's ever been. And so words do have consequences, whether you're for human rights or whether you're against them, whether you believe that people have the right to say what they need to say, which I do, but I also have the right to hold them accountable for what they say, which I also do.
And what if people who truly have been harmed by others' behavior? We don't have time to give full honor to your own story, but you yourself have been a survivor of a great harm, a great transgression. You are a survivor of sexual violence, of incest, and thankfully have lived to live and thrive. And yet, you know, a great harm has been done to you and to many other people. And do you have thoughts about how, and in part now, part of what's occurring is that people are seeking redress for great harms that have been done to them, sometimes in ways that other people don't agree with, but nevertheless, harms have been done. And I just wondered if you have some thoughts about that.
Well, hurt people do hurt people. So a lot of what we see as harm is seen through a trauma-informed lens. And so I'm of course, a rape and an incest survivor. And not only did I suffer incest at the hands of my cousin, but I ended up parenting his child for 47 years. So, you know, being a co-parent with your own rapist is not the way you want to become a mother. And so I could overreact sometimes every time I feel that someone is trying to dominate me or intimidate me or shut me down or make me feel as helpless as I was at 14. Or I can put those emotions of that 14-year-old back behind that glass wall of memory and separate it from the present. I can be that. I can do that. Actually, with therapy, that's how I learned how to do it. Mm-hmm. It was automatic. But I really do think that we don't heal if we won't allow ourselves to heal. I find that a lot of people have built such a hardened identity around being a victim that they don't want to let it go at any cost. And I really want to ask them how well that's working for them. Because the victim, by definition, is a totally disempowered position to be in. So you're giving away your own power because you get you console yourself by saying, I'm a victim and everything that I dislike re-victimizes me. I don't know how that works for people. And so I really try to say that we can be more forgiving of each other. When I, even as a rape survivor, I taught Black feminist theory to Black men in prisons who had raped and murdered women. And that was when I was in my 20s. And so I'm always going to ask the question, why did we have better forgiveness practices in the 1970s than I'm seeing in the 21st century?
Professor Loretta Ross, thank you so much for talking with us. I do hope we'll talk again.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And so do I. What an amazing woman and teacher. And finally, we have been hearing tonight how coronavirus disproportionately threatens the lives and the livelihoods of women. But despite the pandemic, women are still reaching new heights. Of course, President-elect Biden has named America's first female Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, who's in charge of the nation's purse strings. Germany, Europe's largest economy, is introducing mandatory quotas that will require companies to put women executives on their boards. And the former Soviet Republic of Moldova has elected its first female president. And here in the UK, Oxford University professor Sarah Gilbert is winning major plaudits for leading the team that created the latest COVID vaccine with AstraZeneca. All of this in a day's work. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.